Well, I want to thank all of you in here for selecting our ministry, Risen Jesus, to be one of those ministries you support this year. Your contributions will certainly make a difference, and I will look forward next week to being able to give you a little bit of brief on what our ministry is about and what we've been up to and where we're going with it. It's pretty exciting. So let's talk a little about today's subject and next week's subject, but I want to introduce it with a short video.
You say either, and I say either. You say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You like potato, and I like patata. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, patata, tomato, tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
So if you listen to skeptics, like people like Bart Ehrman and some other New Testament scholars who are skeptics or philosophers who are skeptics, you'll hear them point out all sorts of gospel differences. Things like, well, did they eat the Passover, Jesus and his disciples eat the Passover meal, or was it not a Passover meal? Was he crucified after the Passover meal was to be eaten, or was he crucified before the Passover meal was eaten, as the Gospel of John seems to suggest? Did Jesus carry his cross all the way, as is portrayed in the Gospel of John, or did Simon of Cyrene come in and assist him, as we find in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke? And when Jesus is crucified between two thieves, did both thieves curse him, as Mark says, or did one thief repent, as Luke says? Well, it depends which gospel you read, I suppose, right? Is what Ehrman would say. And then when the temple veil split, did it tear in half before Jesus died, as Luke says, or was it after, as Matthew says? It depends which gospel you read. And that's just the crucifixion scene. Then we come to the resurrection. How many women went to the tomb? Was it Mary Magdalene, as is portrayed in John, or were multiple women involved, as we find in the other gospels? Well, it depends which gospel you read, right? And when they got there, did they see one angel, as we find in Matthew and Mark, or were there two angels, as we find in Luke and John? It depends which gospel you read. And then, when they came back, was it Peter and the beloved disciple who ran to the tomb, or was it Peter? Well, it depends which gospel you read. And where did Jesus first appear to his male disciples? Was it in Jerusalem, like Luke and John say, or was it in Galilee, as Matthew and Mark have it? Well, it depends which gospel you read. And by the time people like Bart Ehrman gets through this litany of all these differences in the gospels, the average Christian is sitting in the pew saying, "Say it ain't so." Well, it's so. And if we read the Gospels carefully, we will see these differences. So what are we to do with these differences? Well, this is something that I gave a whole lot of thought to. I had debated Bart Ehrman. We've become friends, actually. We've debated publicly 6 times. And we have stark disagreements on religious and political issues, but we've become friends and we treat each other in a very collegial manner. So it's been a lot of fun getting to know him, but he's just simply wrong on a lot of these things. In one of our debates, he was presenting all these gospel differences and a number of other reasons why we shouldn't trust the gospels. And so I remember just a few months after that, I was teaching a grad level course on the resurrection of Jesus, and we got through the whole course and we're in the last day, and what I had the students do is to watch the debate on the resurrection that I had with Bart Ehrman, and then we would stop it after each like opening statement and rebuttal, and we'd discuss it. And then at the end, I'm asking them, you know, what they thought, because I had taught them the same things that I had applied in that debate. And they said, "Oh, yeah, Dr. Lacona, you've definitely won the debate." But then there was this one girl, and she said, "Well, yeah, but you know what? He had a lot of attacks against the Gospels that you didn't answer. Why didn't you answer them? Like Gospel differences, authorship, these kinds of things." I said, "Because that's not what the debate was about. The debate was about did Jesus rise from the dead? And I pointed out in the debate that he granted all the facts that I granted. So even if the Gospels were as poor sources as he claims that they are, and they are not, but even if they were, it wouldn't matter given the case that I gave, the historical case, because I didn't use the Gospels. I used the writings of Paul, and he grants all the facts that I presented. So it's a matter of methodology, and you can see he failed on that. Do you understand that? And she said, yes, but it has rocked my faith what he did. I know that Christianity is true, but I don't know that I can trust the Gospels anymore. And at that point, I thought, well, I need to come up with something. I need to start working on this because I asked the class, I said, how many of you feel the same way? And a number of them raised their hands. So immediately I started to work on those. Well, the number one objection against the reliability of the Gospels is contradictions. Contradictions. These discrepancies, these differences in the Gospels. I mean, I just presented some in the Passion and Resurrection narratives of the Gospels, but there are much more. So what I did, I wanted to see how common these were in the Gospels. Because I'd thought about it before, but you know, I didn't really spend a lot of time on it, and I knew that there were books written to try to harmonize these things. And I just would basically refer to a person to one of these books, or I'd go and look myself if I was troubled by one of the differences. I never really gave it much thought. So I went to the Gospels and I started, you know, I'm a New Testament guy, and I learned how to read the New Testament in its original language, Greek, in my schooling. So I started reading through the Gospels in Greek. And the benefit that that has, I'm 58 years old right now, and I've been a Christian since age 10, and many of you know exactly what I'm talking about here, that we have read the Gospel so many times that our minds can go on autopilot, right? Because we know what the story says, and we just kind of, we don't pay much attention to it. So but when you read it in another language, one that's not your primary language, you really have to concentrate. And so when I'm reading through them in Greek, and I can't read Greek as well as English because that Greek is a dead language, and as I'm reading through, I'm starting to see all these kinds of differences, and I start to write down the differences. And before I know it, that catalog of differences had grown to more than 50 pages. So what do we do with these things? So I spent 8 years doing it. It resulted in a book that was published 3.5 years ago, Why Are There Differences in the Gospels, published by Oxford University Press. And this has some groundbreaking research in it. Really excited about it, and I'm going to be talking to you about just kind of giving you a summary of some of the stuff I found in these next 2 weeks. So if gospel differences is something that this is kind of interesting to you, but it's not a passion, anything like that, don't buy the book. Because it's an academic book. It's kind of heavy. It's not light reading. But if you are really into this stuff and if you like Christian apologetics, then that can be for you. All right. So here's how we start. If you were going to write about an important person, what genre would you use? And I left my wireless clicker at home, so I'm going to be closely related, working with this computer here. So if you were going to write about an important person, would you write using the genre of horror fiction, poetry, or biography? Biography. And if you were going to write a biography, if you were a biographer living in the first century, and you were writing to readers who were living in the first century, and you were writing about a person who had lived in the first century, would you use the rules for writing biography that were in play in the first century, or those that wouldn't come into play until more than 1,500 years later? First century. You'd be surprised the Baptist churches that get that wrong. I used to work for the Southern Baptist Convention, and when I did at the North American Mission Board over there on North Point. And when I came there, I had this stereotype that Baptists were like just so far behind, you know, the culture. It's like if the 1950s ever return, they'll be ready, you know. And but after working for them for 6 years, I found I was only 80% correct. All right. So let's talk about the Gospels as biographies. Why do scholars believe that the Gospels are biographies? And this is something that scholars believed for a long time until about the 19th century, and then they changed, and throughout the 19th and most of the 20th century, most scholars started to think that the Gospels were of a unique genre, that they were just one of themselves, nothing else like them. This was a new genre. But then in the 1970s, there were a couple of scholars that came along and proposed that, no, the Gospels are ancient biographies. And then it caught on, and Richard Burridge came out with a book in 1992, What Are the Gospels? He had tried to disprove that they were ancient biographies and ended up proving that they were biographies. And so he changed his mind, and that book pretty much reversed the opinion of New Testament scholarship to now think that the Gospels are ancient biographies. And here's why. In a biography, it focuses on the main character rather than an event, an era, a government. So like Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War in the 4th century BC, that is a history because it's reporting about a war. Or if you're looking at something like Livy's Roman History, it's a history, okay? So it's not focused on a single person, but a biography. Yes, it's going to report historical events, but it's focused on a single individual. That makes it a biography, right? In a biography, we learn something of the main character's ancestry. Now, this is for ancient biography, okay? We learn something about the main character's ancestry, and then we move along rapidly to the beginning of their public life. You ever wonder why the Gospels don't include more about Jesus' childhood? It's because they're ancient biographies. Ancient biographies were not concerned to do that. They wanted to just talk about the person's ancestry and then boom, right into their public life, whether it was the military or politics. And this is what we have in our Gospels. In Matthew and Luke, you've got the genealogies, right, which talks about Jesus' ancestry. In Luke, you just had that one short story about him staying in Jerusalem, and his parents are worried about him. They go back when he's 12 years old and find him in the temple. But other than that, we don't find anything else about Jesus' childhood in the Gospels. It was, boom, it's right up to his baptism and then into his ministry. In the Gospel of Mark, you have Mark saying that Jesus is a fulfillment of Isaiah the prophet, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, right? And so he's the fulfillment. He's God's son that's come among us. And it tells about, the rest of the gospel is going to tell us about who he is. In John's gospel, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, right? So it's talking about God with us and how he came to us. And then it's, boom, right into his public ministry. Ancient biographies were the same general length, between 10 and 25,000 words. It was this way so that they could fit them on a single scroll. Scrolls were really expensive back then. And biographies were meant not only for education, but also for entertainment purposes. So a lot of times you would sit down after dinner and someone could read a biography to you. It would take about 3 hours. You say, wow, that's a long time. Well, how long do you watch TV at night? They didn't have TVs back then. And very important is that in ancient biography, the main subject's character is illuminated through his words and deeds. We find this discussed in Plutarch's Life of Alexander the Great. He says that that you'd have to excuse him if he doesn't talk about a lot of the famous battles in which Alexander was involved, because he says this is a biography, not a history. And the purpose of a biography, he says, is to bring out and illuminate who the character is, what kind of a person they are. Just as he says, as when you're painting a portrait, the painter will spend a whole lot of time on the face and especially the eyes, because that tells us who that person is. And so he says, so will I report the events and the things this person said that illuminate and reveal who this person was. So we keep that in mind. Now, we come to Mark's gospel and we find something very interesting. Skeptical scholars for years were saying that we don't find Jesus' divinity in Mark. We don't find that clear until we come to John's gospel, where he's clearly said to be God in John's gospel, but in Mark he's the Son of Man and he's the Messiah, but you're to keep that secret. But when you take into consideration that Mark is an ancient biography, then Jesus' character as divine comes to light. So remember, Plutarch says, the purpose of the biographer is to report those events and things the person said to illuminate who they are, their character. So when you come to Mark's gospel, Mark chapter 1, it says, as in fulfillment of prophecy, as Isaiah the prophet said, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight his paths. Now, we don't have Jesus coming and preparing the way for God, the way of the Lord. We have John the Baptist preparing the way for Jesus. So what does that say from the very beginning on who Jesus is as portrayed by Mark? He's God. He's the Lord. He's preparing the way for the Lord. Mark chapter 2, Jesus heals a paralytic and forgives him for his sins. And the Jewish leaders there say, well, that's blasphemy. Only God can forgive sins. That's right. Chapter 3, all right, Jesus is casting out demons, and the Jews who were there, the Jewish leaders, were saying, this is Satan casting out Satan. And so Jesus gives a little parable. He says that there, if you want to rob a strong man, you have to come into his house and bind him first, and then you can rob him. And what he's saying by that is Satan is the strong man, and his exorcisms are evidence that he has bound Satan and now is plundering his kingdom of souls. Well, what human can bind Satan? Then you come to chapter 4, and you have Jesus calms the wind. They wake him up. He's asleep. The boat is in trouble. They wake him up. He calms the wind. And the Old Testament says that this is something that God does. In chapter 5, Jesus raises someone from the dead, something Ecclesiastes chapter 8 says it's something only God does. Now, you say that, wait a minute, we have apostles and you have Elijah, Elisha, who raised people from the dead. Yes, but they did it by calling on God to do it. Jesus raised the dead by his own power. Chapter 6, Jesus walks on water, something Job says only God can do. Chapter 9, Jesus cast out a demon after his disciples were unable because he says this kind only comes out by prayer to God. But Jesus didn't pray. He just spoke the word and the demon came out. And on and on and on throughout Mark's gospel, this is what you have. So Mark is clearly presenting Jesus as nothing less than God's uniquely divine son. And we see this by recognizing it as ancient biography. Now, so recognizing that the Gospels are ancient biographies will shed light on helping us to read it to see what the writer is saying with a little more clarity. But ancient biographers took some liberties, some things they report with a little more flexibility with the details, little elasticity with how they report things than some of us might feel comfortable today. And the best way I know how to explain this is to ask you, how many of you are married? Okay, most of you. Well, then you all know what I mean when I say there's a guy version of the story and there's a girl version, right? So, that's right. So, typically, we know, and of course I'm generalizing here, there are exceptions, but for the most part, women like details, and lots of them. They'll tell you what happened, where it happened, when it happened, why it happened, how it happened, who was there, what they were doing, what they were wearing, what they were saying, what they were thinking, and how they were feeling. And guys are different. We like bullet points, right? Get to the bottom line. Game's coming on in 5 minutes. So, you know, I think most of us guys, we've had the experience where we've been talking on the phone to a friend, and our wives are in the background, and they say, you know, it didn't happen that way. You forgot to mention this, and you forgot to mention this, and it didn't happen here, it happened here, and he said it this way, not this way. And we're thinking, come on, we are not trying to deceive. Guys report the relevant facts. Women report everything. And they like to do so with the precision of a legal transcript, right? It's not a matter of the right or wrong way to report something. It's a matter of different objectives. Well, ancient biographers sometimes reported the guy version, and sometimes they reported the girl version. Now, let me explain how they would do the guy version. And this is where compositional devices come in. And I'm going to be able to describe these to you from two different sources. The first we'll cover this week, and they're called compositional textbooks. We'll cover the second next week. Compositional textbooks were when children, usually of the elite, were learning. And they'd get into their mid-teens, usually guys, sometimes you'd have women, but usually guys, they get around their mid-teens, 13 to 15 years old, and they had already learned how to read and write, but now they're going to learn how to write well. And so there were these textbooks, compositional textbooks, and they had these exercises in them. And the exercises they would have to repeat, that would give them an example, and then they have to repeat these and do them over, and they'd do these on wax tablets, and once they finished it, then they'd smooth out the wax, and they could write again on these things. So they would learn how to do things like, especially like paraphrasing. Now, one of these, the earliest compositional textbook that is extant today is by a guy named Theon, and he probably wrote in the first century. He wrote in Greek. And around that same time, there was a compositional textbook written in Latin by a guy named Quintilian, and then they had some that came after. Now, a lot of these textbooks will give the same kinds of exercises. But what's interesting here, Theon gives us a hint that he's not the first to come up with this. So in section 59, he says, we have not only invented some additions to the exercises as described by others, but also we have tried to give a definition of each. So he's saying where his compositional textbook differs from others, he's come up with new exercises in addition to those that have been around already. We just don't know who wrote those and those others because Theon's is the earliest that we have of these compositional textbooks, but the first century. But we do know that in Jesus' day that people were learning how to read or to write well using these compositional textbooks. Now, most people were illiterate, but for those who could write and those who could write well, they had most likely used these compositional textbooks. Theon goes on to say, training in exercises is absolutely useful, not only for those who are going to be orators, but also if anyone wants to be a poet or historian, or if he wants to acquire facility with some other form of writing, these things are, in effect, the foundation of every form of writing. So it wasn't just people who were going to write fiction or poetry who would practice these exercises in the compositional textbooks. They would be historians and biographers as well. For paraphrasing, Theon says paraphrase consists of, and he gives a couple of different ways, a few ways in which you would learn to paraphrase. You change the form of expression while keeping the thoughts. There are four main kinds: variation in syntax, or the grammar, by addition, by subtraction, by substitution, plus combinations of these. Now, let me just give you a little example. Theon would go on and he'll take a paragraph out of Thucydides, and then he will paraphrase it using these. Now, I'm not going to do something that long. I just want to do something, make up something, and show it to you so it's quick and it's easy to understand. Excuse me. So changing the syntax, the grammatical structure. There are many ways to do this in Greek. We can do it in English, but a whole lot more ways in Greek. But just to give you an idea what this looks like, if the original statement is, today I heard Mike lecture, if you wanted to change the syntax to paraphrase that, like let's say you send an email to one of your kids or your grandkids and you say, today I heard Mike lecture. And your child comes back and says, hey, let me show you how to paraphrase that. You could say, I heard Mike lecture today. And just change the syntax, the grammatical structure. Or what if you wrote in that email and said, today I heard Mike lecture, and then your spouse comes up and says, hey, I can help you paraphrase that. Say it a little bit differently by adding, today I heard Mike lecture on gospel differences. So you're adding to the thought, but it's an accurate thought. Or subtraction. Instead of today I heard Mike lecture, if you wanted to paraphrase by subtracting, abbreviating, you just say, I heard Mike lecture. What about substitution? Instead of saying, today I heard Mike lecture, you might use some synonyms in there, carrying the same meaning, like, today I listened to Mike teach. So you can paraphrase in these ways. Now, there were other ways to paraphrase, and let's look at some of these. Theon says, there are other ways of varying the content along the lines discussed in the chapter on narration. He had a chapter on how to write a narrative. So that's what he's talking about there. For example, recasting an assertion as a question. Recasting a question as a potentiality. Or similarly, other forms of expression that we mentioned. I'll show you some examples in a moment. Narrative. In his chapter on narrative, he says narrative is characteristic of historians. So one of my critics has said, see, narrative, that's like more for fiction writing. No, Theon says narrative is characteristic of historians. And he says a history is nothing other than a collection of narratives. Theon goes on, since we are accustomed to setting out the facts, sometimes as making a straightforward statement, and sometimes as doing something more than making a factual statement, and sometimes in the form of questions, and sometimes as things we seek to learn about, and sometimes as things about which we are in doubt, and sometimes as making a command, sometimes expressing a wish, sometimes swearing to something, sometimes addressing the participants, sometimes advancing suppositions, sometimes using dialogue, it is possible to produce varied narrations in all these ways. Wow. What Theon is saying here is you can report about the past as a historian by changing things around. So instead of giving it as a statement, you could have a question or changing it into a dialogue and doing all these kinds of things. What does that tell us as moderns today? It tells us that when we are reading about ancient history, that we should keep in mind that things may not have happened exactly like we're reading. We should be looking for the gist of how things happen. It gives us an essentially faithful representation of what occurred. Theon says, if we wish to use a dialogue form, we shall suppose some people talking with each other about what has been done, and one teaching, the other learning about the occurrence. He talks about thought is stirred in a number of different ways. Same thing about changing to a question and all these things. All ancient writers seem to have used paraphrase in the best possible way, rephrasing not only their own writings, but those of each other. Theon goes on to give an example. It's a short one I found, so I'll share that with you. In Homer's Odyssey, which was written, we don't know exactly when, but perhaps around the 9th century BC, he's got a statement in there that talks about an army coming in and capturing a city and taking off its inhabitants to slavery. And he reports it as, they kill the men and fire levels the city and some lead off children and other deep-zoned women. When Demosthenes writes the same thing, Demosthenes, in the 4th century BC, he paraphrases Homer there as saying, "When we were on our way to Delphi, necessarily we saw all these things, houses destroyed, walls thrown down, a place deserted by those in the prime of life, few women and children, and pitiful old men." And then Aeschines in the 4th century BC says, "Look at their disasters in your imagination and think you are seeing their city captured. The throwing down of walls, burning of houses, temples robbed, women and children led into slavery, old men, old women learning late to forget liberty." So you can see how they paraphrased one another's works there. It's kind of interesting. So just to keep up with our brief examples, instead of saying, "Today I heard Mike lecture," you could turn that into a question. Did you learn? Did you know what I heard Mike lecture today? Inflection, that's kind of interesting. Inflection isn't what we think about it, like inflection. That's not what we're talking about. Inflection, back in those days, it was done in two different ways. Number one, you could change a singular noun to a plural, or a plural to a singular. That's how you would inflect it. Or you would change the grammar of something, not just the syntax, but you change something, let's say, from a direct object to a subject of a sentence. So let me show you how that could work. "Today Mike gave a lecture." If you inflected that, you could take that singular and change it to a plural. "Today Mike gave lectures." That would be inflection, a way of paraphrasing. I know we don't do that today, but that's one way that they would do it back then. Or you could change the actual kind of grammar there. Instead of saying, "Today Mike gave a lecture," you could say, "Today a lecture was given by Mike." So lecture, you change that from being a direct object to a subject. You could create a dialogue. Instead of saying, "Today I heard Mike lecture," you introduce another person, and one has the speaking, the other you have are teaching, the other have learning. So, "What did you do today?" "I heard Mike lecture." "How was it?" "Great. I learned some of the reasons why the Gospels often differ from one another." That would be a means to paraphrase back then. Again, we wouldn't do that today, but they would do it back then. You say, "Well, what about the Gospels? Do we find this kind of stuff in the Gospels?" That's a great question, Dewey. Thank you so much for asking that. Indeed, we do. I want to take you to the temptation in the wilderness that we find. It's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but it's not described in Mark. So in Matthew and Luke, in Matthew, the first temptation is Jesus is hungry, stone into bread. The second, Satan takes Jesus to the highest point in the temple and tells him, "You know, you can jump off here and the angels will help you." And the third is, "If I show you all the kingdoms of the world, they can all be yours if you will bow down and worship me." In Luke, the order of the second and third temptations are the opposite. So one of them seems to have changed them around. We don't know which, but one of them changed that, the order. But here's where inflection comes in. In Luke, Satan says, "Jesus, you're hungry. So since you're hungry, why don't you take this stone, singular, and turn it to bread, singular." Now, in English, when we say bread, that could be singular or plural, right? But in Greek, you wouldn't say breads, but the way the noun is, you could tell by the ending whether it was singular or plural. And what Satan says to Jesus in Matthew is, "Turn these stones, plural, into bread, plural." So one of them has inflected that noun from either a plural to singular or singular to plural. Let's look at another example, not of inflection, but of some order. It's the parable of the sower, where some seed fell amongst rocky ground, some fell amongst shallow ground, some fell in good ground. And that fell in the good ground, Jesus says in Mark, it reproduced itself. It yielded 30, 60, even 100-fold. When you read the same parable in Matthew, Matthew inverts the order so that it yields some 100-fold, some 60, some 30-fold. And Luke, he does subtraction. He just says 100-fold. He abbreviates. Let's look at Jesus, the story about Jesus healing a man with a withered hand. Now, this is found in Matthew, Mark, and in Luke. So because it's found in all three Gospels, and it comes immediately after the story of Jesus' disciples picking grain on the Sabbath. It says they went from there to the synagogue, and there Jesus healed a man with a withered hand. And so because it appears in the same order in all three Gospels, we know that any differences cannot be accounted for in the story as, well, he healed someone with a withered hand on different occasions. Okay, same story here. So let's look at how the story is told in Luke and in Mark. Luke says, on another Sabbath, Jesus entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so that they might find a reason to accuse him. Now they watched to see if he would do it, and it says, but Jesus knew their thoughts. So they're not saying this. They're not asking Jesus, are you going to heal this man? They're wondering. They're just sitting there watching to see if he's going to, but he knows what they're thinking. And so Jesus says to the man with the withered hand, come and stand here. And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to him, I ask you, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, to do good or to do harm, to save a life or destroy it? And after looking around at them, so they're all still silent, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. Let's read the same story in Matthew. Jesus went on from there and entered their synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they, the Jewish leaders, asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Wasn't that interesting? In Mark, they didn't say anything. Jesus knew their thoughts. But Matthew has turned this into a little bit of a dialogue. Isn't that cool? He said, and which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? And on, and he heals the man with the withered hand. So we can see Matthew changing a statement into a dialogue. Parable of the vineyard and wicked tenants. Now, this is interesting. So we've got this in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in Matthew, he sends three servants. They beat, they kill, they stone. And Luke, and in Mark, he sends one servant. They beat, and they send him away. A little bit different. Then you come to step two. Mark and Luke give step two. He sends another servant, and they beat him. They send, and they treat him shamefully, send him away. Then you come to the next step. In Mark and in Luke, the owner of the vineyard sends another servant. You say, well, wait a minute. You know, Matthew is just kind of, he's abbreviating here. Yes, he is. That's one thing he's doing. But watch this. Next step. Mark says they send many others. Luke doesn't say anything else. Matthew says he sends more than he sent the first time. So that means that, according to Matthew, Matthew is abbreviating, but he's saying, instead of saying, he's combining, well, he sent one, then he sent another, and he's just some. No, he said they sent three. Whereas Mark and, so he's just giving us the guy version. And now we've seen a couple instances of this, so we can see a pattern that develops in Matthew this way. And if we look through Matthew's gospel more, and I could show you in more examples, and I'll show you some next week, we can see that Matthew does have a tendency to do this more than Luke and John does. Matthew uses these kinds of compositional devices more than the others. And then finally, Matthew says, has the Jesus say, they killed the son. Mark says, they killed the son and cast him out of the vineyard. And Luke says, they cast him out of the vineyard and then they killed him. A little reversal in some order. Say, well, which one did Jesus actually say? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. probably more like Mark or Luke had it, since we do see Matthew abbreviating and giving us the guy version more. If we want the girl version more closely to how Jesus actually said it, we'll probably get it more from Mark, okay, or Luke. Here's something else about that parable. Jesus says in the Gospel of Mark, he says after they kill the son and cast him out, Jesus says, what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. But watch what happens when we read it in Matthew. Jesus says, so when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? They said to him, he will put those wretches to a miserable death and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their seasons. Jesus asks and answers his own question in Mark. But Matthew has the Jewish leaders answer the question. More of the dialogue here. Let's go on. Elaboration is language that adds what is lacking in thought and expression. What is lacking can be supplied by making clear what is obscure, by filling gaps in the language or content, by saying some things more strongly or more believably or more vividly or more truly or more wordily. Each word repeating the same thing or more legally or more beautifully or more appropriately or more, you get the idea. So how many of you've been out, you had a conversation with someone, maybe you shared your faith with someone and you had this back and forth with them. And you were kind of pleased with the way things went. But as you're in your car and you're driving home and you're excited because you want to tell your spouse about this, as you're driving home, you think, you know, I wished I'd said that. If I'd said it just a little bit differently, it could have been clearer. And you're going through this in your mind because you want to be prepared better next time, right? And you get home and what do you tell your spouse? You give them the clearer version. Nothing wrong with that. And that's what Theon is saying you can do when you're writing. You can recast things in this kind of sense, in a clearer manner. Now watch this. This is Jesus on divorce. We find this in both Mark and in Matthew. In Mark, the Pharisees ask Jesus if it's lawful to divorce the wife. And he says, well, what did Moses command you? And they answer, well, Moses permitted it, if you know, write a certificate of divorce. And Jesus says, because you're hard hearts, he wrote to you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, he made them male and female. Now, Matthew goes and paraphrases that as the Pharisees ask Jesus if it's lawful to divorce the wife. The same thing. But Jesus answers, haven't you read that the one who created from the beginning made them male and female? In other words, now he's quoting from Moses. Rather than asking them, what did Moses command you? He's giving back to them what Moses had said. And the Pharisees say, well, why then did Moses allow divorce? Because of your hard hearts. So you have some difference here. A statement is recast as a question, and the answer is attributed to someone else. We find this something similar when the scribe comes, the lawyer comes up to Jesus and say, what's the greatest commandment? In one gospel, we have it, Jesus saying, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbors yourself. And the scribe says, you've answered well. In the other gospel, you have the lawyer say, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, well, what do you think? And he says, love God with all your heart and all your being. Love your neighbors yourself. And Jesus says, you've answered well. So which one? I don't know. But we get the gist of what that conversation was. Okay. And again, you can see just through the color coding here how the content from the various statements that was said was changed around just a little. Now, I think it was last year that we talked about the synoptic problem last summer. So I'm not going to go over that again, except just to remind you that most scholars today, and for good reasons, they believe that Mark was the first gospel written and that Matthew and Luke used Mark as a primary source and then supplemented with their own testimony and material that they had. Okay, if you missed that series, you can still see it, or not see it, but you can hear it. Go to YouTube, type in my name, Mike Lacona, and you'll see my YouTube channel. And then you want to go to playlists. And then you'll see, we've got a number of playlists. You'll see the Risen Jesus podcast. Go to season 3. It's all on the synoptic problem. It's actually one of our most popular seasons than the synoptic problem is. So, all right. Now, this is an interesting one on divorce. In Mark, Jesus says, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, let's just suppose that you are the original audience to whom the Gospel of Mark is being read. It's a Sunday morning. It's a worship service. And the person is up there, and they're going to read the entire Gospel of Mark to you. And their church services were long. And so they come to this text, and Jesus says, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. Are there any reasons that allow for allowing divorce? This is the first gospel. You're the first audience. Any reasons? But that's not what it says, right? That's not what Jesus says in Mark. Remember, Matthew hasn't been written yet. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. Is there any grounds for divorce? It wouldn't appear that way, right? However, Jesus often spoke in hyperbolic language in order to get one's attention. If your right eye makes you sin, rip it out and throw it from you. Unless you hate your father, mother, brother, sister, wife, and children, you cannot be my disciple. We really think he meant those? We're to hate? We're to rip our eyes out? That's shock language. It's hyperbolic language to get the point across. Was Jesus doing that here? Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. I think he's doing that here. It's like if someone says, you go into work, if whoever works hard will get ahead. Now, on the surface, if you just take that very literally, there's no exceptions. If you work really hard, you will get ahead at work. You'll get promoted. You'll get raises. But what if you're caught with drugs or stealing and you get fired and you come back and say, now, wait a minute. The handbook doesn't say, it says if I work hard. You know, we have to make sure we're not taking things overly literally and we allow for exceptions. And so Matthew, with this elaboration, he clarifies. Whoever divorces his wife, he has Jesus saying, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. All right? So I suppose that if Jesus were around, he says, if you divorce your wife and marry another, you commit adultery. If someone said, Jesus, what if my wife committed adultery? Can I divorce her? Oh, yeah, of course you can then. You know, but he's just speaking here. And then, of course, infidelity is not the only exclusion there that allows divorce. Paul's later talking, if you're married to a non-believer and they want to divorce you, you can divorce them. But if they want to stay, then you have to stay married to them. And I would suggest that there are probably some other exclusions given our different kinds of, like back then, capital punishment was major. But let's suppose that you live in the state of California, the People's Republic of California, and you're married to a serial killer. He doesn't rape the women. He only kills them, right? And he gets put, only kills them. And he gets put in prison, life without parole. Are you allowed to divorce that man? He said, well, no, because he only killed them. He didn't rape them. You know, so he didn't commit adultery. He only committed murder. Well, of course, you'd be able to divorce a person like that. You'd have to look at things culturally there. And I think I'm running out of time. What am I supposed to end right about now? 12 minutes I got? No, I mean, serious, how long do I have?
Mike, you can allow for Q&A if you'd like, a couple, some questions.
Okay, let me just see if there's something on here I definitely, I'm on my last two slides. How about that? Okay, so whoever, in Matthew, whoever loves father or mother, I already mentioned this one, right? So I already covered that. So we're done. All right, so let's next week we're going to be looking at part two on why there are gospels differences in the gospels, and you may find, I promise you, you're going to find it even more interesting. It's pretty cool stuff. So let's open up for some questions. Yes.
Coming with the mic. Hang on.
Oh, by the way, this gentleman who's going to be talking here, he came up to me and introduced himself. I've never met him before, but I have always wanted to. This is Dr. Michael Sabom. He is a cardiologist, retired cardiologist, and he is a leading authority on near-death experiences, has written on near-death experiences. I read his book years ago, been wanting to meet him for a long time, and he came up and introduced himself. And so it's like, I'm excited.
Well, thank you. I really forgot my question now. I'm wondering, seriously, have you heard of the rather new genre of books coming out called creative nonfiction? And if so, where does creative nonfiction end and fiction begin? Mm. And this is particularly true with the near-death experience and the genre known as heaven tourism, where people are giving factual, quote unquote, information that's then taken out and used that may or may not correspond with scripture, and is creative, is considered to be creative nonfiction, and okay.
Yeah, good question. Now, I'm not familiar with these books you're talking about. They're not talking about ancient history, right?
No.
Okay, so I'm not familiar with those. What I can't, but you do ask a very relevant question, and I don't know that there are any. Okay, so there's a book that came out last year by a friend of mine named Craig Keener. It's called Christobiography. And so we know that ancient biographers could take liberties in how they reported things. And we can actually see them taking some liberties, as I showed you some here, and we'll look at some next week as well. I've got a bunch of them in that book, Why Are There Differences in the Gospels? We can see the extent to that they go, and we can also see that John goes to it to a much larger extent than Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. And I think that he probably did because he's writing a few decades after the others. He knows that those are already in there, and he wants to do things a little different, maybe clarify some things. Some Johannine specialists have called John a theological paraphrase, where they're bringing out the theological implications of Jesus' teachings more clearly. And this isn't something that's just with, I mean, this is even something conservative scholars are saying. So F.F. Bruce, anybody hear of F.F. Bruce? Probably a lot of you. Okay. So F.F. Bruce, he said that the Gospel of John is a paraphrase of the freest kind and a transposition of Jesus' teachings into another key. So that's kind of interesting. So, but John, it's really difficult. I like what N.T. Wright says about John's gospel. He says, I think about John as I think about my wife. I love her very much, but I don't claim to understand her. So let me just say that when we say about to what end would they go, let's focus on the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because John's a little bit different here. Craig Keener wrote Christobiography, and for the last several years, he and a number of his doctoral students have spent time looking at not only Gospels, but the Greco-Roman and Jewish authors to see and compare how they would tell the same story. Now, I've done it with Plutarch, how Plutarch would tell the same story in multiple of his things. He would compare with different authors, he and his students, and they found that, yes, there was, for the most part, there was a limit. You could change things around, but these were all peripheral details. You could recast the way a person said something, but for the most part, you can't invent like whole scenes. You can't invent events that never occurred. You can play with those events with some of the details, but you can't invent new events, things like that. And so it's 500 and some pages, his book. Small font, and It's tedious to get through if you're not really interested in this stuff, but it's extremely informative. And recently just won an award, too. It's a great book.
Mike, I understand that Matthew was written perhaps more to the Jewish audience from studying.
That's correct.
And Mark is more to sort of the, I mean, including the Gentiles and or Greeks, if you will. Wouldn't that influence maybe their the language that they use? I mean, as far as Matthew's concerned, in using terminology and words that may have been more, you know, suitable to the Jewish Sanhedrin or whoever. You know,
so absolutely. Yeah. You'll find things like in Mark, Luke, John, Jesus speaks of the kingdom of God. But in Matthew, it's the kingdom of heaven. You'll find a couple of occasions of kingdom of God, but Matthew pretty much says kingdom of heaven because the Jew didn't want to say God. You know, so they would substitute the term heaven, called a circumlocution, something that would substitute but carry a lesser meaning, but you know what it's referring to. So that would be the case, yeah. And Matthew and John are the most Jewish of the Gospels.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mike, I know Lee Strobel has quoted you in one of his recent books on miracles.
And I didn't know that.
Okay. Well, okay. That may be a tough. This may be a tough question then. But I know he's interviewed you for previous books like The Real Jesus and so forth. But yeah, in Miracles, he talks about you addressing this topic and talking about spotlighting and some other things.
Oh, cool.
So my question was, which this could be interesting. My question was your comments along what he said about that.
Yeah, well, since I wasn't aware of that, I mean, I like Lee Strobel. He's a great guy. He's a friend of mine. I haven't read his book on miracles. Oh, okay, yeah. So, yeah, anything Strobel writes is great. I mean, he's just a fantastic communicator. And what I love about Lee, too, for a guy who sold over 10 million books, if I'd sold 10 million books, my head would be, like, huge. He is very humble, just a great guy. And we'll be talking about spotlighting and some of these things next week. Any other questions? All right. Well, thanks so much. Let's close in prayer and appreciate your coming. I'll look forward to being with you all next week. Father, thanks so much for this group and thank you for this time that we can just get into your word and understand it better. And Lord, I know that some of this is just kind of academic and we might think about what practical value does this have? Well, it's your word. And just as we want to know more about our spouses and when we're dating them, especially, we want to learn more about them just to learn about them. Lord, we want to just learn more about your word and understand it and appreciate it and love it even more. We thank you in Christ's name. Amen.